2021-06, Coral Lakes. As you can tell, I'm not the judge. Here's the judge. He's going to run the...
Good afternoon. I am the retired judge. Can't impersonate a real one. Not now, anyway.
I didn't realize that.
as the chairman indicated, we're here on appeal by Shell Brothers, LLC, represented by Ms. Mowry, Mr. Toner, and Mr. Moyer. Got that right, I think. And the respondent, in this case, the appellee, would be Sussex County Planning and Zoning Commission, represented by Mr. Robertson. All right. I am the hearing officer appointed by Sussex County Council. I'm a member of the Delaware Bar since 1975, thereabouts, I guess. I'll rule on any legal questions and procedure. Decision on the merits is for council limited to Sussex County Council. I met with, and the record should reflect, with council on or about May 5th, I think it was, and we outlined the procedure. Both sides submitted written submissions, and the Planning and Zoning Council had first opportunity to respond to what had already been filed on May 13th, and Shell Brothers responded or replied on May 19th, and I assume the commission has the memorandum. I have them and have reviewed them. We agreed that each side would have 30 minutes for their presentation, and then there would be questions from the members of council if they so desired. Because of the nature of this hearing, the appeal is on the record. There is no additional evidence to be taken, no other testimony, just what was before the Zoning and Planning Commission and the legal issues involved. The record reflects that the last submission to initiate the process or was January 18th, 2022. There was a hearing on January 27th, 2022, decision deferred, further hearing on February 10th, where the matter was considered or presented again. And on March 7, 2022, there was a request to grant the application because of the failure to comply with the 45-day rule. In other words, if it wasn't acted on, then it should be approved. On March 10th, the denial of the application to approve, and that was the end of the process. The appeal was lodged on April 4, within a 30-day period of time. The standard is clear. Was the commission's decision the result of orderly and logical review of the evidence, and did it involve the proper interpretation and application of the law and or chapter of the law involved? There have been approximately, and council are not bound by this, but what I would consider three errors of law. One was there was no automatic approval and the 45-day period had expired. The second is that there was a failure to act upon the motion to grant it following the request. And the third is the failure to state a basis for the decision. And lastly, fourth ground would be no basis. There was no basis for the denial, all the criteria having been met, at least according to the appellants. The record consists of only that which was before the Zoning and Planning Commission, and the everything was supplied, including the transcripts of all the hearings that are referenced, and the matter is now before Sussex County Council. And I would assume the appellants wish to address.
Yes. Good afternoon, council members, Judge Tolliver, clerk, Everett Moore, Todd Lawson. Thank you all for being here this afternoon. I'm Kate Mowry of Richards, Layton & Finger, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Shell Brothers LLC in support of its appeal from the Planning and Zoning Commission's March 10, 2022 denial of the preliminary plat application for subdivision 2021-06 for Coral Lakes, as I'm sure you all know. Before I begin, I do have extra copies of the presentation that's on the PowerPoint. If you
have one. Sure.
I am joined by Jeff Moyer and Phil Micah from Richards, Layton & Finger, as well as John Horner, counsel from Shell Brothers, In addition, we have engineers from GMB who have been working on the Coral Lakes project. As Judge Tolliver indicated, there will be no new evidence here today. Everything is on the record below, but they are here in case there are any technical questions that we need answered. I'm going to just briefly go over our arguments. It's all in the papers that have been provided. I intend to stay within 30 minutes, but I would like to reserve 5 minutes at the end for rebuttal. And then I also like to obviously take questions from any of you that have questions. You know, as Judge Tolliver indicated, the question here for counsel is whether the Commission's March 10th, 2022 denial of Shell's preliminary subdivision plat was the result of an orderly and logical review of the evidence and involved the proper interpretation and application of the law. And on both points, the Commission fell far short in this circumstance. The Commission did not perform an orderly and logical review of the evidence and did not apply the proper interpretation and application of the law. In reviewing this question, I will just note at the outset that you all are sitting in a little bit of a different role than you normally do. I know that legislative capacity is how you often proceed. Here, you're in a quasi-judicial capacity. And in that role, like a judge, you're here to apply the law to the facts and review the commission's decision below to determine if it complies with county code and state statute. So we're not here making decisions on behalf of constituents or in politics or anything else. You're here more as a judge in your quasi-judicial capacity. In this determination today, you have full discretion, and I wanted to remind you that you do, to reverse the decision below, and that's what we're advocating. And here is the appropriate remedy. For reference, I'm putting up Subdivision Code 9939B2B, which states the council may reverse a decision upon a finding that the commission made an error in its interpretation of the applicable sections of this chapter, or the commission's findings and conclusions were not the result of an orderly and logical review of the evidence. Judge Tolliver did a nice job of summarizing the timeline here. I do have that on what is slide 3. I will just briefly note that November 25th, 2020 was the initial submission of Shell Brothers' preliminary plat application. That's almost a year and a half ago. January 18th, 2022, Shell provided application materials in support of approval of its plat, and that was conditioned off of a 10-day rule within Rule 15.3.1 of the Rules of the Planning and Zoning Commission. Once the public hearing was finally set for January 27th, Shell had 10 days prior to that to provide additional submission of materials, which it did. The hearing occurred on January 27th. Shell presented its preliminary plat with evidence and testimony. Opposition was heard, questions were answered, and at that point, later that day, the commission deferred a decision for February 10th. February 10th, the commission then deferred assessment again, and no assessment was scheduled for February 17th, which was the next scheduled meeting of the commission. Around 48 days from the January 18th submission from Shell, Shell wrote to the commission pursuant to 9 Delaware Code 6811, requesting that the commission deem the plat approved because it had been over 45 days since submission. And that is either whether you go from the November 25th date of submission of the preliminary plat or the January 18th submission. As you know, the commission did not deem the plat approved, and so it proceeded with the hearing on the decision on March 10th, 2022. Commissioner Stevenson moved for approval of the plat, explained how the evidence, the record, supported that motion. The motion was seconded, and then what may have been an unprecedented situation, Commissioner Stevenson then denied her own motion, as did three others, and it was denied in a vote 4-1, with no findings or conclusions provided in support of that decision of denial. As you know, April 4th, Shell Brothers appealed, and June 3rd is the deadline for decision from council pursuant to the subdivision code. I mentioned the March 10th decision was unprecedented. It certainly was a shock to many involved. What appears to have happened here is that the commission yielded to the opinions of a small but vocal group of individuals that had opposed Shell's project, but who had provided no basis under the law for denial. So we've put out, as we mentioned in our reply paper, a majority, almost two-thirds of the opposition letters submitted to the commission in opposition were from just three communities adjacent to Coral Lakes and were submitted by different individuals in one household or multiple letters signed by the same individuals. No matter how many oppositions there were, no matter the number of opposition letters, they didn't provide reasons for denial. As we've laid out in the papers, all of the requirements of the subdivision and lot, zoning codes were met. There's no really disagreement on that in commission's response. And political whims and personal opinions have no place in the commission's subdivision considerations. As explained in Shell's notice of appeal, the General Assembly created and delegated certain powers to the Planning and Zoning Commission to review land use. And that was done through Title IX or Chapter 68 of the Delaware Code. However, those powers are not unfettered. As Mr. Robertson has previously and correctly explained at the March 10th, 2022 hearing, there are guardrails, and you'll hear me say that a couple times today, to protect applicants and to ensure a fair process in the subdivision application process. One of those guardrails is 9 Delaware Code 6811, and I'll put that up as slide 4. And this is what we've been calling the 45-day requirement in the papers. And this code section provides that the commission shall approve or disapprove a plat within 45 days after the submission thereof. Otherwise, such plat shall be deemed to have been approved, and a certificate to that effect shall be issued by the commission upon demand. And it's important to understand that the purpose of this provision is to make sure a plat application does not sit in limbo for long periods of time and ensure that all applicants receive a fair process. It can't just be submitted and sit there forever at the whims of the commission. Developers, landowners need to know what's going to happen with their lands in a timely fashion. The Delaware Supreme Court has likewise spoken on other guardrails that define the commission's power and discretion to approve or disapprove a subdivision plat. Specifically, in one of the cases we cite in our papers, Tony Ashburn versus Kent County Regional Planning Commission, the Delaware Supreme Court explained that the commission acts in a quasi-judicial capacity in terms of subdivision applications and does not have unfettered discretion to deny an otherwise legally conforming subdivision application. And this is very important here. The commission must review the application and, if in compliance with the codes, approve it. It does have some discretion in taking into consideration different factors, but those would be considered in terms of conditions on an approval. It would not work towards a denial, assuming those other considerations are outside of the code. If the code is not met, then it can be denied. Here, the situation is everything met the code, and yet the application was denied, which is not appropriate under the guidelines of the Delaware Supreme Court. The Delaware Supreme Court gave reasoning for these guardrails in the Tony Ashburn decision, and I would just like to read from that. I'll try and read slowly when I get to reading quotes. I get fast, but when people purchase land zoned for a specific use, they are entitled to rely on the fact that they can implement that use provided the project complies with all of the specific criteria found in ordinances and subject to reasonable conditions which the Planning Commission may impose in order to minimize any adverse impact on nearby landowners and residents. To hold otherwise would subject a purchaser of land zoned for a specific use to the future whim or caprice of the Commission by clothing it with the ability to impose ad hoc requirements on the use of land not specified anywhere in the ordinance. The result would be the imposition of uncertainty on all landowners respecting whether they can safely rely on the permitted uses conferred on their land under the zoning ordinances. Unfortunately, the commission's decision in this case did just that. It left Shell Brothers with a lot of uncertainty with respect to whether they can safely rely on the permitted uses conferred on their land, and unfortunately only after Shell spent substantial time and resources on its application. To compound this, the commission is actually well aware of these guardrails. And Mr. Robertson aptly and correctly defined these guardrails at the March 10, 2022 hearing on Shell's application. And if you've read the transcript, it is in there. Mr. Robertson stated, subdivisions are, by Delaware Code and Delaware law, the Delaware Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, they are governed by the county subdivision and zoning code. And so, if you know, if it's a permitted use, if it's permitted and it meets all the requirements of the specific code, the zoning of the subdivision code, then you know it's permitted. We can condition it on certain aspects, but that also has to be based upon the record. And a lot of people, and understandably so, feel like it should be approved in this location, or it shouldn't be approved because there's too much traffic, or it shouldn't be approved because there's other subdivisions in the area, or they just don't want it, and the land should be left vacant. And you know, I think everybody up here, and he was referring to the commissioners, can understand that perspective on things, but that's not what the law says. And Mr. Robertson went on to explain the commission's guardrails and to reiterate that a decision cannot be based on opinions. Instead, the commission must review the evidence in the record against the zoning and subdivision codes, and if in compliance, approve the application. The commission did not heed that advice and went right through those guardrails. Instead, it appears they took their judicial caps off, put legislative caps on, acquiesced to political whims, and those are grounds for a reversal here today. As outlined in our papers, there are three clear errors made by the commission, and I urge you to read those papers. I'm sure you have, and I incorporate all of those arguments here. I'm not going to go through all of them again. I don't want to take up your time. But first, the first argument is purely a legal argument. It's that the commission's failure to approve or disapprove Shell's preliminary plat within 45 days of its submission pursuant to 9 Delaware Code 6811 is an error of law and a failure to logically and orderly review the evidence. And I still have 9 Delaware Code up, so you can recall what it is. It's the 45-day requirement. There was also an error in not deeming the plat approved when Shell demanded it be so after 45 days. So there are two legal errors there kind of wrapped up into this one 45-day requirement. As I explained in the timeline, Shell submitted its original application in November 2020 and its final materials and support in January 18th, 2022. And as of March 7th, which was 48 days after the January submission, the commission had not approved or disapproved the plat. So Shell reached out to the commission asking the plat be deemed approved, and the commission did not do so. That is a clear violation of the unambiguous language in the Delaware Code, which I have up in front of you. Shell's interpretation is based on the express language that submission of a plat is exactly that, the date the plat is submitted to the commission. And in our view, that was November of 2022, and at the very latest, January 18th of 2022. The commission's position, as you know, is that it acted within the 45-day window because the submission that I'm speaking of in this code does not occur until the close of the record after a public hearing. And there were less than 45 days between the close of the record on January 27th and decision on March 10th. The commission's interpretation makes no sense, and it does not follow the express language of the code. As set forth in our reply, there is no support for that position. They are basically adding in language here to suggest the commission shall approve or disapprove a plat within 45 days after the submission and public hearing thereof. That is not in the statute. And that is not in the Sussex County Code or the commission's procedures. In fact, the sources that the commission cites are actually in support of Shell's position. In 6810, a final hearing, or is it 6811? I think either way, it refers to the submission and then public hearing separately. They're separate and apart. And even in the subdivision code itself, this is really interesting, the procedures are laid out. And the submission is separate in part from the public hearing. So at section 99.8, the title of that section is submission of the preliminary plat. It lays out the process for submitting your preliminary plat. Then the next section, 99.9, says the title is public hearing on preliminary plat approval or disapproval. It's a separate, another separate section on public hearing. There's nothing to suggest that one has to be completed in order for there to be a submission. And for good reason, I'll actually turn to the next. I forgot I have a slide on this, which you guys were probably looking at without me. And there's good reason for this. The commission's interpretation would basically allow it to hold open the record for as long as it wanted, right? The commission's response, it says, we might have questions. We might have to get public comment. Well, that means that there's no deadline for closing the hearing. It could remain open as long as they wish. and that eviscerates the statutory time limit and denies procedural due process rights of the applicants, which I previously described. The commission also argues that it's not practicable to have the submission of the plat application in November of 2020 be the deadline that triggers the 45-day rule because there's too much work to be done, basically, is their position. And, you know, as we set forth in our reply, if the procedures required as part of the subdivision application take longer than 45 days, then they need to be amended, and they are, in fact, in violation of the Delaware Code as presented. For these reasons, it is apparent that the Commission erred in its application of the Delaware Code and interpreted the subdivision code in violation of the Delaware Code and did not proceed with an orderly or logical review of the evidence. And the remedy here is approval by Council of Shell's plat application as the application was submitted to the Commission. So I know there was some question in the papers as to what our remedy is. And for this violation, the 45-day requirement violation, it is reversal. It is approval of the plat as submitted. There's nothing else provided here in this code provision for any other remedy other than approval, as it should be deemed approved as submitted. Remanding here doesn't even make sense. It would actually further violate the 45-day requirement set by the Delaware Code and extend the time Shell's application is in limbo. Shell's second argument on appeal is very straightforward. Shell met all of the requirements of the subdivision and zoning codes, and the commission did not approve the plat. That is point blank a legal error under Supreme Court law and a failure to proceed with an orderly and logical review. As I explained earlier, the commission's power to review land use applications was delegated by the General Assembly, but it also has some guardrails, and the commission did not stay in those guardrails. Let me see. The next slide just provides a little bit of more of the testimony on guardrails from the hearing. Guardrails are set on commission's consideration of a subdivision. It cannot be based on opinions. It has to be made based on the record and applying that record to the law. If the project meets all requirements of the zoning and subdivision codes, then it is permitted. As a result of this clear misapplication of Sussex County Code and illogical review, the council has the discretion per 9939B2B, which is the subdivision provision that I showed you earlier. Per that, you can reverse the commission's denial and approve Shell's application. It should be approved as submitted, since no reasons were given for denial. There were absolutely no reasons given for denial. Everything in the record was the motion itself presented by the commission stated all the reasons it Shell met all of the requirements of the subdivision and zoning codes, and there weren't any reasons given for the denial. To the extent the council wishes to place conditions on the cluster subdivision, we propose that the council include only those submitted by Shell in its Coral Lakes proposed conditions of approval submitted on January 18th. Remand is, again, inappropriate because there's nothing to fix on remand. All evidence has been gathered, questions answered, opposition heard, and the record was closed as admitted by the commission. So to send it back down for another hearing is really only prejudicial to Shell, who had already put forward its entire presentation in support of its application. Finally, the third argument in Shell's appeal is that the commission provided no findings and conclusions for its denial of Shell's preliminary plat, rendering its decision illogical and not orderly, and a violation of, I'll put them all up here, 9 Delaware Code, Section 6811, Section 15.4 of the Commission's Rules of Procedures, and procedural due process. The Commission has not argued that it did provide any findings and conclusions in support of denial, and the record, in fact, provides reasons for approval, including the Commission's motion itself. Again, the only remedy here really is reversal. The commission had a complete record and a chance to issue its decision and to applying the law to the evidence, and it failed to do so properly. It should not be Shell should not be punished for the commission's failure to follow the law. To now allow the commission a do-over, basically, to go back with 2 months under its belt to issue a post-hoc decision would be unfair and prejudicial. In closing, I here have on the last slide just the reasons reversal is required here. I think I've gone over them all. And so I just wanted to say, in closing, you're sitting here again in your quasi-judicial capacities, where your judicial discretion is limited to review of the record below and consideration of the commission's actions under the law. And here, based on the record and the commission's actions, it is a clear-cut situation where reversal is necessary to address the errors. At this time, I'm happy to try and answer questions as you have them, or to hear any thoughts, but otherwise, I am done the presentation.
Are there any questions?
Questions down here? No? Oh, questions?
Debating whether. I want to be clear that I understand what you're saying. You're suggesting that if it were remanded to planning and zoning, that there is no possibility that they could deny, that they that would not be even an option for them? That's not a possibility?
Well, it's our position that it shouldn't be remanded at all because the hearing was closed. The commission has admitted the record was closed. No additional questions were needed. A motion to approve the plat was made.
But you're suggesting that there's no basis for denial or there's no possibility that they could
correct
make
our
a denial?
Yeah, correct. Our position is that everything in the record was in support of the plat application being approved. And I'm saying that we met all of the zoning and subdivision ordinances, and so it should have been approved, yes.
In your opinion?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And based on the record. I mean, there's no suggestion that there were, that, I mean, the commission didn't provide reasons for its denial, so
right.
there's absolutely no,
right.
nothing on the record suggesting that we didn't.
They didn't provide those reasons, but not to say they couldn't, depending on how they interpret the record.
I think they were in violation of the Delaware Code, the Commission's procedures by not providing findings and conclusions.
Okay.
And so I don't think having them go back and provide reasoning for denial would be fair in any circumstance. It would be prejudicial to Shell.
Understand.
No. Judge, can I ask you a question? I do have a question.
I'm sorry.
And I heard your last statement there. Under what rule do you think applies to the to your argument that the commission did not give any reasoning for their vote?
Under what rule?
Yeah, what rule would apply that would require them to do so?
So under 9 Delaware Code section 6811, it says the grounds of disapproval of any plat shall be stated upon the records of the commission and a copy of such statement shall be furnished to the applicant. And then section...
Is there a debate and discussion prior to the vote considered? A reason for denial or approval?
I don't think, no, because that would have been prior to the actual disapproval itself. And nothing's been pointed to us in any of that, any of the transcripts in support of a denial. There is some discussion prior to a decision being made, but there's no suggestion that that's a discussion about the, for any reason of denial.
Is anyone else?
I'm sorry.
Good.
Thank you, and good afternoon again, Judge Tolliver, members of council, Mr. Moore, Mr. Lawson, Ms. Torbert. Just for the tape, my name is Vince Robertson. I'm the attorney for the Sussex County Planning and Zoning Commission and attorney with Parkowski, Girk, and Swayze. I do agree with Ms. Mowry that this is certainly an unprecedented situation that we have in front of you all this afternoon. You do have my written statement, so I'm not going to restate that in its entirety or even really insignificant portions of it. I am going to touch upon a couple of things, mainly starting with the 45-day requirement that is really at the heart of this, or one of the parts that's at the heart of this. I think that's important beyond just this appeal. Because it has implications not just in Shell's case, but how the county processes and proceeds with any subdivision application. So with that, I just wanted to point out that it's the commission's position that we have been compliant with state code in that regard. There was reference in Shell's written submission that somehow we were not compliant or in conflict with the county code. I'm not sure what refers to that or what interplay there is with that, because really what this is all driven by is Title IX. State code, Title IX establishes both the trigger date and a great deal of the pre-hearing processes. Chapter 99 really just sort of fills in the gaps in what's set out in Title IX. And while we've spent a great deal of time looking at Section 6811 and 6810, you have to also read those with other parts of Title IX. For example, and I cited this in my written submission, Section 6961B establishes the whole TAC process, the Technical Advisory Committee. It doesn't refer to that by name, but it talks about sending out these subdivision applications to other state agencies for review. Title IX, Section 6962, talks about DLDOT and the interplay between Sussex County and DLDOT on a subdivision application or rezoning, but it talks about subdivisions in this case. And as you all know, I think, from dealing with land use applications, that's a substantial lift for everybody, for the county, for DLDOT, for the applicant, its engineers. Often that includes a TIS and a TIS review letter, which, as much as we would like that to happen quickly, as we all know, it does not. There's a lot of negotiations and technical work that goes into that. So you have to read 6810 and 6811, not by themselves, but also with those other provisions of state code. Then, setting that aside, I think it's inherent that you have to have staff review. Their argument is that if the plat's compliant, it must be approved. Well, we can't just take somebody's word for that. There has to be a staff review that occurs to make sure that, in fact, the plat that is submitted is compliant with our subdivision code. And then, also, we have the public notice requirements, and there's some nuts and bolts parts of that. As you know, we have to publish by 6811, it talks about this. We have to publish in two newspapers of general circulation. When you do that, that takes about 3 to 4 weeks of lead time just to get that done to meet newspaper deadlines to hit the hearing dates. And then, of course, we have FOIA that we have to comply with in terms of agendas and all that and posting and everything else. The one thing, too, that's kind of missed in all this, which wasn't quoted, in fact, it wasn't quoted by me, was a sentence in Section 6811, Title IX, Section 6811, that no plat shall be acted on by the commission without affording a hearing thereon as outlined in Section 6812 of this title and notice of the time and place of which must be sent by registered mail, etc. So despite what Shell has argued that the public hearing is not part of the submission, actually when you read that language in 6811, it does reference that you have to have a public hearing. And that's the same section that talks about the 35 days. So when you read all those together, I think the only logical conclusion is that the 45 days starts at the end of or the closure of the public record on any application for a subdivision. For the sake of argument, I'm going to flip this around a second. Even if, and I do not concede this one bit, but even if it was possible that all of that could occur within 45 days, which would be a Herculean effort of unimaginable proportions to do, what we would be dealing with is such a last-minute fire hose of information and data that a meaningful hearing, deliberation, and vote would be just about impossible. The 10-day rule, if we're going to apply that, that shrinks that time period even further because essentially then you're down to 35 days to gather all your information, know what it is. If you're the applicant, be able to present a meaningful submission and public hearing to the commission and be able to, you know, make a presentation that makes sense that, as we heard about with regard to the Ashburn case and some of the others, establishes that you have satisfied all those code requirements. In this case, this wasn't a 10-lot subdivision, it was a 315-lot subdivision. So imagine trying to gather all that data, if we accept Shell's argument, which again, I don't, but if we, just for the sake of argument, think through that. That means that the county, the applicant, the public, everybody else would have to decipher, again, that fire hose of information and data within 45 days, make a public hearing, and have one shot at it. Because keep in mind that if what we hear from these folks is accurate, there wouldn't even be an opportunity to defer, take an action that night. to consider all this information that has been thrown at everybody in 45 days. It doesn't make sense from a statutory interpretation point of view or a common sense point of view. I would just add, there's another element of this too that's just a practical consideration. Just the pipeline of applications we have while all this is going on makes that even further impractical. The 10-day rule, they suggest that the 10-day rule in the Planning and Zoning Commission's rules is the date of submission. And again, that's not so. It is the closure of the public record. And there's some relevant language in that rule that supports this. There's really two points. The first point is, as it states in the rule, it applies to information to be presented in support of an application. As I said in my written submission, that really only has to do with what is going to be relied upon during that public hearing, the notebook, you know, PowerPoints, that sort of thing, so that we have it, we, meaning the commission, and the public has an opportunity to review that. And the reason behind that is just so there's a good public discourse that, the commission doesn't get sandbagged with information at the last minute that nobody's aware of and can't be prepared for. But really, the second point I think is more relevant is, under that rule, whatever is provided must be given to the Commission's secretary not later than 10 calendar days prior to the meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission at which the application is to be presented and heard. Significant words are not later than 10 days prior. What that also means is that it sets the last possible day for providing the information. It does not state the earliest possible day for providing that information. So under Shell's argument that the 10-day rule applies in our rules, if that's the case, anyone could submit documents 46 days prior to the hearing, and then on the 45th day, the day before the hearing, call us up and say, well, 45 days have expired, you have to approve it, without ever having had a public hearing on the application. An applicant could game the system by providing its information 46 days, for example, prior to the hearing, and then again claim that its application could be approved. And that simply does not make sense. This is the due process impact of what we're dealing with here. And Shell, rightfully so, their attorneys represent Shell, and they're focused on the due process of the applicant. But there's another element of due process that is important here, and that's of the public. We have to have public hearings on these subdivisions. I will say the law is what it is, and I stand by my statement before the Planning and Zoning Commission. However, we have to have the public hearings to make sure that law is complied with. And participants in that public hearing process are members of the public. So we can't use or interpret this 45-day requirement in such a way that excludes the public from participating in the process. I would add this too. There's an element as I was thinking through this of, sort of be careful what you wish for, because what ends up happening if we use the 45-day requirement that Shell's arguing for, we get a due process violation because potentially not only do we not have a public hearing, but that 45 days might run in the midst of the public hearing. I did touch upon this in the written submission, but we need a complete record to be able to decide in favor of or against subdivision application. And I say this, be careful what you wish for. Oftentimes when we have a subdivision application, we're missing information. We don't have a complete set of information from DLDOT, or we don't understand the DLDOT information because of whatever stated in there and additional information is required. We frequently, because of timing or because of unclear information, don't have, or there may be questions regarding septic feasibility for a subdivision or sewer capacity for a subdivision. So there's additional information that's required. Which happens more than I would like. We also get questions that come out of the PLUS review process. Frequently, and unfortunately, that PLUS process raises sometimes more questions than answers, sometimes requires greater clarification than the information it purports to provide, and oftentimes there's inaccuracies in that information. If we were to stop this process because of some 45-day date circled on a calendar without holding the record open to get answers to these questions, we have done a disservice not only to the public, to ourselves, but also an applicant. I mean, you almost force the commission into having to act on something with an incomplete record, and that incomplete record may not shine a favorable light on an applicant, for example. So it's in everybody's best interest to have as complete a record as can possibly be made with regard to these hearings.
So you disagree with the applicant's assertion that the 45-day rule that they quote under Title IX, 6811 doesn't apply? But
no, there is a 45-day rule. I mean, that's not in dispute.
But it doesn't kick in because you just physically don't have the ability to meet the timeline?
No, I say it doesn't kick in because the submission doesn't occur till the public record is closed. The submission, in my opinion, when you read 6811, 6812, with those other provisions of Title IX that talk about the information that you have to receive, plus the requirement that you have a public hearing, which is right in 6811, means that submission means when everything is submitted to the commission for its decision. When that final gavel slams and the record is closed, that's the start of that 45 days. Otherwise, there's no logical way that we can go through deliberations and consideration of an application. As I said, up until that point, the record is incomplete, which, if the record's incomplete, the commission may not have sufficient information to decide that, in fact, a subdivision application does comply with the Title IX requirements and it does comply with the Chapter 99 requirements. And they may end up with a denial that they might not otherwise get if the record stayed open to gather that information. And I think that's further supported by the fact that one thing we all agree on is that the commission does have the ability to put conditions on an approval. That was in the Ashburn case, as was read to you all this afternoon. And to be able to make meaningful conditions, the commission needs to be able to consider all of the public record, everything. And again, the 45 days starts at the time frame when that public hearing is closed. So I'm going to conclude on this one in that, again, there's only one logical conclusion that complies with due process, the provisions of all of Title IX, not just 6811, although 6811 does require a public hearing, read as a whole, common sense that the closure of the public hearing and the closure of the record is the date of submission, which triggers the start of that 45-day period. And in light of that, I don't think there's any dispute that the commission acted within 45 days of the closure of the public record. On that, I think we agree. What we disagree with is when that 45 days started. But it's the commission's opinion that when the record closed, that 45-day clock started to run. The commission acted on the 42nd day, so therefore it was compliant with those requirements of Section 6811. Just one thing, too, that I want to touch upon that I wasn't really prepared to, but so that there's not alarm, or at least it's not unresolved from the commission's point of view. There was a comment that remanding this matter back to the commission, or I guess frankly these appellate proceedings in general, somehow violates the 45-day rule because it just extends it even further. I would disagree with that because Section 6811 talks about approval or disapproval occurring within 45 days. We can argue on whether the disapproval was appropriate or not, but that disapproval occurred within the 45 days. It happened on the 42nd day. That ended the calculations of 45 days. Whatever happens now, we're in appellate processes, and that doesn't matter in terms of that 45 day. Just like if, when somebody appeals to court, you wouldn't be arguing that they can't appeal to court because of the 45-day rule. With regard to the vote itself, it did follow an extensive public hearing with information presented by all sides, and the commissioners were engaged in the process throughout the questions and discussions that were raised by them. I think that's reflected in the transcript, and I cited some of those in my written submission to you all. And there was even confirmation that there was a state by Commissioner Stevenson who talked about the work that went into the motion that was read by her. As you know, the motion was read. I did give my explanation of the law, which I stand by. I mean, there's no disputing that. The law is what it is. The vote was taken, and it was voted down 4-1. with even the commissioner who made it voting against her own motion. However, it is our opinion that the vote technically complied with the requirements in that it failed to receive those three votes. And under the commission rules, whenever there is a fail to receive three votes, that motion is deemed to be disapproved. So under the rules of the commission, there was that vote, and it just failed because it did not get the three votes. Having said that, and without conceding that there is an error in this process, I would point out that no one here this afternoon or in the written submission has claimed that there was an error in the hearing itself. For example, we don't have anybody suggesting that there was evidence that was considered that should not have been, or that was evidence that was outside of the record that was considered in the vote, or anything improper with regard to the hearing itself. So with that, to the extent that you don't affirm the decision of the commission this afternoon, and if you do desire a remand, that I would simply suggest that the remand go back to the commission and be limited to the vote itself in accordance with the well-established law and subdivisions, and not a complete do-over of the entire hearing, again, since the hearing itself is not at issue on this appeal this afternoon. So with that, I'll sum it up by stating that that 45-day requirement is a long-standing process that Sussex County has adhered to. We adhered to it in this case. The only logical outcome is that the 45-day clock starts when the record's closed. Otherwise, that's not consistent with all of Title IX and just the process that's necessary in these hearings, and it, I think, violates the due process, again, of the commission, the public, and an applicant. And frankly, the vote is what it was. There was a denial. It was a three-vote denial. It did not receive three votes. It was a 4-1 denial, and it complied with the rules of the commission. So with that, I thank you for your time and attention this afternoon, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Question. Did the commission offer the applicant a written decision after the hearing?
I do not believe so, unless staff did.
I'm sorry.
So no written document was prepared, but the minutes would have been typed up and published in the commission's usual way, so they would have been made available. So, but the answer is no to the questions.
More questions?
Okay. Thank you.
So I just have a few points in response. I will put these down. First of all, there's no, as I previously said, there's no basis in a statute that submission is after a public hearing. You all saw the express language of 6811 at slide 4. That is what it says. There is nothing later on in the statute that provides that a submission is not deemed submitted until after a public hearing. And as I said, the statute is clear and not subject to interpretation, right? So they are offering what they say is a reasonable interpretation. We do not agree that it's a reasonable interpretation, but it's flat out not ambiguous. It's clear. There doesn't even need to be an interpretation of this statute. It should just be applied as stated. With respect to the implications that Mr. Robertson spoke about, we're not in disagreement that those different, you know, processes should occur, but they have to either happen within 45 days of a submission. If they're going to happen after the submission, then they all have to happen within 45 days to be within the statute. If there were, I mean, you could do all of that work prior to submission. That would be one solution. There were ways that the commission could have drafted its code such that everything could get done within the 45 days, or would get done prior to submission, and then the 45 days would cover the hearing and this public comment that he's suggesting needs to occur. Or an application could simply be denied if not all of the work got done, right? So I don't think it's fair to say that because there are a lot of procedure to happen and a lot of processes to occur, that you don't apply a statute as written. They would be in violation of the code, the Delaware State Code. With respect to the 10-day rule, I did just want to clarify that it is Shell's position that the submission of the application occurred in November of 2020, which was the submission of its original application. The 10-day rule, you know, the January submission was the last possible date. We were being very conservative in providing that date in our papers. That's the last possible date where there is a submission to the commission, and so that's why we were using that date as a backup date, really. It really should be the November 2020 date. And I think, you know, Mr. Robertson explained that that 10-day rule is somewhat arbitrary, in that they get to pick the date of the hearing, and then our an applicant's submission will be due 10 days before that. So really, it shouldn't be that January date shouldn't be the date of the submission, because they get to decide when the hearing is arbitrarily, and then we have to submit within 10 days before that. And then finally, with respect to, he noted the public's constitutional rights. I think there is case law on by-rate subdivision circumstances where the public does not have a protectable constitutional right. And so that argument would be legally incorrect. With respect to the vote, just because there was a vote, it doesn't show orderly and logical review of the evidence itself, and that was laid out in our papers. Moreover, the vote, as I understand it, the way in which votes are being taken before the commission has actually recently changed, and decisions are now being provided along with the votes, which suggests that it wasn't properly done previously. And then I'll just leave you all, as I did previously, with the reasons that reversal is required here. 9 Delaware Code 6811 does not provide for remand. A remand would be further. And he suggested that, you know, it wouldn't matter now that the approval or disapproval has occurred. But I think the underlying reason for the 45-day requirement would be violated. I mean, we would just be continued to be in a limbo where our application has not been approved or disapproved for in a final manner. We're continuing to have to expend resources in the application process. A remand would be a do-over to allow the commission to try and fix blatant errors made at the expense and prejudice of Shell. And then finally, all code requirements were met. The commission suggested nothing to the contrary. No questions remained open. No further evidence was required, and the record was closed. There's nothing to be done on a remand, and council need only reverse the decision to match the record here.
Any additional questions?
No, sir.
Thank you all for your opportunity to speak.
Good.
For present purposes, the hearing is concluded.
Okay.
It would be appropriate now to have a motion to go in executive session to consider what was heard at the hearing today, and then come back at a later time today.
I would make that motion.
We're going to have the motion will be to go to executive session for pending potential litigation.
Yes.
Motion, Mr. Hudson.
Second.
Second, Mr. Riley. Questions on the motion? We'll take the vote. Mr. Schaefer?
Yes.
Mr. Green?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
Mr. Hudson?
Yes.
I will, yes. We're not going to executive session.